I tried to not get hired. They said, well, what would it take to get you back? And I said, oh, no. Just name something. And I said, well, I would like $700 a week or whatever it was. It was an outrageous number at that time. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And I went to the back and did some code, came back and said, clear, after taxes. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And then I said, I want 8 weeks of vacation a year, which is so nobody would ever get. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And so they kept giving me everything I wanted. And so I was sort of sucked into getting back to radio.
I am not sure if any other introduction would be sufficient other than the one you just heard. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll and your host for Rock Conversations. That was the voice of longtime morning DJ in Boston, Charles Lacuadera. And what a personality he not only was on the airwaves, but still is, as you will hear shortly. It's funny because he wanted to get out of radio to pursue, shall we say, a different habit. And just when he wanted to get out, they brought him back in. Okay, humor me, cheap Godfather impersonation there. But Charles, it's very clear, was a powerful personality on the airwaves and continues to be a powerful personality today. I watched a while back a Zoom gathering of former WBCN employees. I think they were celebrating some sort of 40th anniversary. And while many of them who participated had interesting stories to share, no one could outdo the presence or the stories of Charles Lacuadera. Many Bostonians, as you might suspect, can remember exactly where they were the night Carlton Fisk hit the game-winning home run in Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. And I'll ask, as we get into our interview, I'll ask Charles what he talked about on the airwaves the next morning. But one thing he told me is that he remembers vividly what happened to him that night. And it's probably unlike anything that happened to anyone else. So we will get into that and much more as we have our rock conversation with Charles Lacuadera.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So let's get right to it. There's a song from the late, great Tom Petty, The Last DJ. Is that you?
It depends. It depends on whether you're Ken Shelton, Mark Parento, Matt Siegel, Wolfman Jack fan, whether on The Last DJ. I don't know. That's up to history to decide. I think I was probably the last, I think I was probably the last radio announcer on BCN itself to have total freedom. I think Tom Petty was talking about some New York or LA DJ. He certainly wasn't talking about me.
Well, you can still take credit, and we'll still give you credit for it.
Okay, I'll take it. I'll take anything I can get right now.
Describe what it was like when you arrived at WBCN. What was the station like, and what did it mean to the city and the community at that point?
Well, first of all, I was not with the first wave of people that started WBCN. BCN started with Joe Rogers and Sam Copper, Tommy Hedges, Jim Perry, Al Perry. They all started it in the middle, I think, of 68. I didn't come to Boston until late in 68. Around Christmas time, I came back. And I didn't come back to work at BCN. I was working currently, or at that time, at KPPC in Pasadena. That was one of the first underground stations. And I came back to Boston because my mom was sick. And I was listening to the, twirling the dial. And I caught BCN and I called them up. I said, wow, you guys are great. You know, what's going on over there? And I think Jim Perry was the guy who picked up the phone. And he said something like, oh, you're that crazy guy from Pasadena that mixes classical music and rock and roll. I said, yeah, that's because I'm not good at either one. I don't know that much about either one. So I just sort of mix them together. he said, oh, okay, well, everybody thinks you're kind of like, everybody out here thinks you're some kind of a trendsetter. So I said, no, not that at all. Anyway, he said, why don't you come visit the station? I'll show you around. So I went and I visited, and apparently right around that time, and I was going to stay there for a while because, like I said, my mom was sick, so I wasn't planning on going back for a while. I guess at the same time, Peter Wolf was leaving to form a band. At the time, it was the Jay Giles Band or something. Those of us who were from California didn't know how to pronounce
it. You didn't know he might have been destined for his own sort of greatness at that point, huh?
Right. And also, Tommy Hodges had already left and was, I guess, was going to come back eventually. But he left to become a dentist. Sam Copper and Steven Siegel and all those guys got together and offered me to try out. And I did a few afternoon shows. And it was, you said, what was it like? It's interesting because even though I was from Boston, I had been in California for 8 years. So I was totally California minded. So the first thing I did is that, I said, hey, how are you doing? And I read a commercial for the Harvard Co-op. I called it the Harvard Co-op instead of the Harvard Coop. It sounded to me like, it looks like co-op to me. People called up, you stupid bastard, go back to California. And then I said, here's one of my favorite groups. And I played Arthur Lee, who had the group called Love at the time, which, by the way, is lead singer of Led Zeppelin. Oh, my God.
Robert Plant.
Yeah, Robert Plant's favorite group, favorite performer and best friend is Arthur Lee. And Arthur Lee diagnosed with cancer, in terminal. So they had a big concert for him, and Plant actually did the emceeing. And Arthur Lee and the group Love never really hit it big time. They were sort of big in California. So I played, I think, Orange Skies by them. And people called up and said, what is this shit? Go back to California. We don't want to hear your California song. And so I got sort of reamed my first couple of days on the radio. But
I'm kind of sensing, that you said they thought you were a trendsetter. Now I'm sensing this trend. You advertise for the Harvard Coop, and then you go into this band that no one knows and likes. It's a pretty good trend.
Well, I didn't really go into it. I just, it was one of the songs I played. I just added, I'm sure I played Hendrix and Dylan and whatever. What's now known as classic rock, but in those days it was like pioneering rock. And I played, maybe Judy Collins, Someday Soon, whatever. And then I threw in Love. So anyway, I didn't get a big welcome, but I did get hired.
I talked to Oedipus recently, and he said when he took over as program director, he had to bring some structure to the station. I wonder how.
That's a euphemism for I was the person that the bottom line people in New York designated to fuck BCN over and take it and make it commercial. And let me just say this before you go on about what you were going to say. Oedipus was one of my best friends. And second, if Oedipus didn't do it, someone else would have. Oedipus was designated to take the station commercial. And in those days, there was a sort of a little mantra, which is if you want to have great ratings, you've got to have bad radio. You have to play the same songs over and over because most people, even those people who think they're really hip and cool, when they've only got 20 minutes on the way to work or 40 minutes on the way to work, they don't want to hear John Lee Hooker and Canned Heat doing a 20-minute song. They want to hear the Eagles. They want to hear songs they can tap their feet to, and this is what gets ratings. And so Oedipus and Tony Berardini together brought BCN way up in the ratings, way up. That's when we killed. In fact, most people who were BCN listeners and say they love BCN, the golden days, they were the people who came over from the AM radio stations to listen to WBCN. So definitely it worked. although it was the death of radio as I knew it.
For someone like you, who had come from freeform, who had, as you admitted earlier, had kind of freeform or the freedom to do what you wanted to do at BCN, how was that marriage of bringing some structure on Oedipus's part with your freeform? Were you able still in the morning to have a certain amount of ability to do what you wanted and play what you wanted?
No, but it wasn't as bad as it sounds, because Oedipus and Tony Berardini came from that school of underground rock. They weren't necessarily a part of it, but they grew up listening to it, and they loved it, and they knew what it was supposed to be. But they also knew that they couldn't do it, because it was the death of a lot of stations. New York, I think it was WNEW, or is it Whiteport and Lemon Juice, WPLM, or whatever that station is.
Right, right.
Yeah, in California, a lot of those stations went down totally, because the announcers were so wrapped up in playing, you know, like 10 train songs in a row, or 15 long songs that no one ever heard of in their life. And a lot of those went down. So Oedipus and Tony Berardini took those. And what happened was, but because they came from knowing, growing up listening to BCN or hearing it as they were, you know, going to college and stuff like that, they knew what good radio was. So Oedipus and Tony maintained a really good mix of hit songs, you know, the Eagles over and over. When I say over and over, I'm not talking about top 40. I'm talking about top 400.
Sure. Yeah.
So they took, and every once in a while they would let me just, you know, play what they call, I think, what do they call it? A cue song or some kind of a word they had it for a song that was totally not something that our commander in chief, Mel Karmazin, would have approved. They would let me do that every once in a while. No, but I was strictly, we had to play the songs they told us what to play. And then when I had like a birthday or a special, when I was going to leave BCN and go to ZLX, or, you know, when something special was going on, they'd sort of give me the whole show and let me do whatever I wanted. So they were really good about, they really treated me really well.
We are talking with Charles Lacuadera, longtime fixture of Boston radio, mostly at WBCN. How'd you go about balancing? Because, you know, I understand you did it very uniquely. You had a certain amount of music you played each hour, but then there was some coverage of news, maybe not the traditional coverage you would get on a news radio station. And then some humor worked in as well. And, you know, that's evolved over the years for stations in general and hosts specifically. But in the 70s, where I think it was probably the halcyon days of FM radio, 70s, early 80s, I'm curious how you went about deciding on your own or with the help of a producer, you know, what to cover, when to cover it. Or did you just kind of go day to day?
With the help of a producer.
Did you have a producer?
That's an understatement. When I left BCN in 1976, because I was totally in the throes of cocaine binging, and BCN was getting in my way of cocaine. So I quit. I told everybody so I could expand in my horizons and go into TV, but it was really because I wanted to go and do coke. So, and I think a lot of people know this story. So I went off for like a year and a half, and I didn't care. I mean, coke is such a deceptive drug. It's such a big lie. You know, you say, oh yeah, if you do coke, you know, you can stay up all night and study for exams. If you do coke with a woman, you know, she'll loosen up for you and it'll be really great. You getting together and stuff. And if you do coke, you don't eat as much, so you don't gain weight and all this bullshit. And then it's not addictive. It's not addictive, but you never want to quit.
it's not like heroin.
If you quit, you get the shakes. Cocaine, if you quit, you can live with it, but you just choose anyway. So during that period, I quit, and then it's Tommy Hadges, who at the time was the program director of WBCN in 78. He somehow got a hold of me when I was off binging somewhere, and he asked me if I wanted to go to lunch. And I said, yeah, I haven't been out of the house in 2 years. I mean, I haven't been out of the house in like 18 months. You know, I'd love to go to lunch. And so instead of going to lunch, he drove me to WBCM. And that at the time, BCM was at the top of the Pruitt, you know, in the 50th floor of the Pruitt. And that's when it was sort of a secret thing that he didn't tell me about, where they just sat there, he and the comptroller, and he was a program director, and the station manager all sat there, and they brought me in his office, and they just started making me office. I really couldn't refuse, even though I'd go to the bathroom and do a line of coke after each offer. You know, I tried to not get hired. They said, well, what would it take to get you back? And I said, oh, no. Just name something. And I said, well, I would like $700 a week or whatever it was. It was an outrageous number at that time. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And then I went to the bathroom, did some coke, came back and said, clear, after taxes. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And then I said, I want 8 weeks of vacation a year, which is so nobody would ever get. And they said, yeah, we'll give you that. And so they kept giving me everything I wanted. And so I was sort of sucked into getting back to radio. And that's where I met my wife-to-be. And then the babies came. And then I quit everything. And now I'm, you know, the only thing I do is have a glass of Chardonnay once in a while. So now I come back to BCN. And I said to Tommy at the time, during that big meeting, I said, why do you want me? I said, my ratings weren't all that great. He said, yeah, but you brought energy back to the station. And he said, we really need that now because WCOZ is killing us and AAF and Worcester's killing us. And so I came back and I said, no more military ads, no oil ads. I put all this stuff out there and they agreed to everything. And then I said, well, I'm not even going to use my name. And they said, okay. So that's how the name Dwayne Glasgow came in. Yeah, so he was the opposite of PC. He would talk about girlies and do all that. And we just had him on Saturdays. And so, and the ratings with Dwayne Glasgow went through the roof because that was before Howard Stern. And that was, there was a whole segment of people out there, the people that now voted for Trump. It was all, you know, that were hidden, that were out there that no one knew about, no one catered to, and Dwayne got them all to listen to him and stuff. So I at the time, so for the first year or two, I got really good ratings because I did all kind of crazy stuff. And then very slowly, then the station started getting bought by, you know, big companies and started going very. So then things all changed, you know. But by the way, the one thing when you said that you have a producer, the only reason I was that successful, and I'm not saying this to be, you know, falsely humble or to think, you know, I really am not that good. I'm telling you the only reason, Rob, that my show kicked ass was because of the people that I had surrounded myself with. I was really good at finding people out there that were really good. Billy West, Eddie Gorodetsky's now like the king of Hollywood. He's got all these different TV shows. If you look at the producer, it's Eddie Gorodetsky. Billy West, of course, everyone knows is like better than I think Mel Blanc ever was as a impressionist and a voice guy. I had so many great production people that I can't, you know, if I start naming them, I'm going to leave somebody out. But I had like an incredible staff of writers and production people and comedy people. They were just all there in Boston. Boston like is the hub, like all these colleges had, and you know, and all of this brain power and all of this music. You know, Matt Siegel used to always say, talk about we you know, go out, hang out sometimes, and he'd talk about his fans. And I told him, I said, man, I don't have any fans. The people who listen to me know more about the music than I do. They know more. They have higher IQs than I have. And they're you know, and all the DJs that I work with are much more talented than I am. Mark Prendo was one of the best interviewers ever. And Ken Shelton knew more about music than, you know, more in his little finger than anything I could ever come up with. So yeah, the reason I was so successful was because I was able to get a really good band of crazies around me. We did some great radio back then.
As a former radio producer many, many years ago, I appreciate that you're willing to give the due to the people around you. It's not always that case when you're the producer in the station at the time, or it doesn't always feel that way. But
Eddie Gordeski won't even talk to me to this day because I probably threw a cart at him or yelled at him one time. In fact, Eddie Gordeski hated Boston so much, not only because of probably me and the pressure we put on him in the show, but also because he had family problems. But he hated the whole Boston era so much that he refused to give Carter Allen an interview for his book, The Rise and Fall of WBCN. He doesn't want to, if you talk to Eddie Gordeski, he's got some friends in Boston, but he would never do anything public for Boston.
Interesting. We are talking with Charles Lacuadera, longtime radio legend in Boston, most of the time spent at WBCN. Now, here's where the questions get a little odd, and if your memory doesn't serve correctly, no big deal. Were you on the air the morning after Carlton Fisk hit the game-winning home run in 75 in Game 6?
On the air?
Yeah, the following after he hit it. So he hit it at night or in the early morning hours.
So you remember I said something about I might have been doing cocaine back on?
Yes, I do recall there might have been a little done. Yep.
So, let's see. Did you ever remember a Boston local group called Duke and the Drivers?
No, I don't remember them.
Well, they were kind of a big ass group in Boston. Duke and the Drivers. Their trademark was a Pez dispenser. You know, one of those things.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
And so I was at the drummer Danny McGrath's house. That afternoon, of Carlton Fisk. And so there were about, and some of the other group were there, members were there, plus some of my friends. And there must have been about 11 or 12 of us watching this game. And hits the ball. And I run up to the TV because I want to turn the volume up. I shut the TV off.
Oh, no. I bet you were the most popular guy at the moment.
That moment was that 5 seconds lasted about an hour because everybody looked at each other and they said, "What the?" And then I tried to get it back. And anyway, everybody in that room that day missed that home run. And I talked about it the next day. I was there. What day was that? What, it was in 78? Was it?
75. Yep, game 6. Yep. And then the irony, if you will, is that they lost Game 7 to the Reds and didn't win the World Series until...
Yeah, but nobody remembers that.
No. Charles Lacuadera talking with us. Do you have any interviews that stick out with rock artists? Either stick out for good reasons or maybe frustrating reasons?
I remember, you said whatever you can remember. And I'm notorious for having a really bad memory my memory, it's so bad. I have two things that are really horrible, memory and a sense of direction. So thank God for GPS, because if GPS hadn't come along, I would be in some kind of an institution today. But, and as far as memory goes,
you'd be turning off the TV with all the other people right before a home run.
But not remembering that I did it.
Right. Let's go back to Dwayne Glasscock. I had kind of this at the end of my notes. And since we're doing this audio-wise, I can at least hold up my notes. The problem with doing any semblance of show prep for me is I just write a word here, a word there, and then I can't read my own handwriting. So luckily I see Glasscock, and I know that we're going to, get to him. If you'll indulge me for a second, the first time I heard that guy's name, I thought back to a time I was on this junket with a bunch of wine journalists, and we were in Germany, in Worms, the birthplace of Liebfraumilch. And the winery owner, just this, gregarious showman, and he could speak English, but he had a thick German accent. Someone raised their hand, said, "Okay, what do you think about synthetic corks versus natural corks versus glass corks?" He says, "Well, the natural cork, it sometimes leaks. The synthetic corks has got a funny smell to it. And the glass cork is kind of expensive." And all the while, this guy and I are sitting there just laughing because we're not hearing cork.
Dwayne had already been on.
Yeah. So Dwayne Glasscock, you talked that you invented him. Well, first used his name and then took his name and turned him into your alter ego. on Saturdays. You alluded to Howard Stern earlier, but it's my understanding that Stern took some of his inspiration from what he heard from Dwayne Glasscock, not from you, when Stern was a student at Boston University. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, that's what people say who are Charles Lacroix or WBCN fans, that Howard got all his stuff from Dwayne or listening to me when he was at BU. So it's hard to, I mean, Howard has never admitted that. I think he said that he liked my show, and Howard never went after me. The only time he'd go after me was in a kidding way. Like he'd say, when he came to BCN, they put him on at night because I had good ratings in the morning. And so, so that it wasn't until I think a few years later where I left to go to ZLX. So when I was on BCN with Stern, he was at night doing the morning show that was recorded. And so he'd go tell his audience, like all over the United States, when the hell is Lacroix going to die or retire or something? You know, he'd always do that kind of stuff. But he never, you know, we talked on the radio. We did an interview because of his movie or one of his books. I forget what it was. And that worked out good. So we always had a good relationship. But I don't think he ever came out and really said that he got inspired from listening to me. I don't think he even... yeah, I think, but if he was at BU during the time BCN was in its heyday, you know, in its glory, he definitely listened to BCN. And did he get inspiration from me or Dwayne Glasscock? Probably, but I think that if he didn't get that, I still think he would have been successful if he had gone to New York University or somewhere in California. I still think he would have been successful. So I can't.
I think it's on your website, which is what, thebigmattress.com? Is that correct?
Daysinthelife.com.
Days in the Life. Thank you. Yes.
D-A-Z-E.
Yes. With that great memoir that you neither had to write, and we don't have to read it. We can just kind of stream through it, right?
I don't have to write it because I forget everything. Plus, it's other people telling stories about what their experience was with me because I didn't remember any of them. That's right. When you asked me about what my interview was, you see, and my memory fit. You know, I forgot what your question was. And one of the things I was going to say was that, and I hope you can keep reeling me in here because that's where I'm going. I have the ADD stuff going on a little bit. So
does my younger son, so I can relate.
Oh, good. Okay. So, yeah. So keep where you're going to be going there so you'll know where to go. But right. Let me go back to that question. My son asked me, he said, Dad, did you ever interview Tori Amos? And I said, the redhead that plays the piano? No. He said, are you sure? And I said, no. So then he asked me another week another week or two later. He said, Dad, are you sure you never interviewed Tori Amos? And I said, I know. I don't remember if I did. Well, about a month and a half later, he sends me two CD interviews that I did with her. One of them was when I was ready to leave BCN in 2000. And go to Hawaii. We had a whole interview where she talked about the Big Island in Hawaii and how great it was. And so I did interview her. So what interview was the most, the best interview that I had that was in Carter Allen's book, was, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas,
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, Hunter S. Thompson, BCN in Boston, as you know, Boston has a problem with New York in general.
Oh, I think that's an understatement of the conversation.
Because of the Yankees. Yeah. But there was a lot of other reasons. I could give you a bunch of stories about how I felt we got screwed over by New York and San Francisco. Okay. Anyway, so Hunter Thompson, San Francisco dude, comes in, you know, it's like my morning show, and he's really got an attitude. So he walks in, he goes, you know, I say, oh, Hunter, that's great. How you doing? And he says, let's get this fucking thing over with. I've been up all night. I just want to go home. I was up late. I just got up. I want to get back out of here. Let's just get this fucking thing over with. And I said, okay, well, I said, hey, would you mind doing us a little favor of doing a promo thing where you say, hey, I'm Hunter Thompson. When I'm in Boston, I love that. He said, I don't do that shit, man. He said, come on, let's do this thing. Let's get this. And I said, okay, Hunter, well, I got a couple of things I got to do first. Just go in the production studio and we'll call you back out. So he goes in the production studio. Bingo, we got him. Because in production studio is, at the time, again, it's going to sound like I'm still, but I don't. I swear on my grandchildren and my children that I have not done cocaine in 20, 30 years, since whenever, 1980, whatever. Anyway, he goes in the production studio, and that's all we needed. So in the production studio at the time, I was getting some really good cocaine that hadn't even been cut. So it was so good, you could actually literally sleep on it. So, it was that pure. And so the cocaine, we never did lines, you know, like everybody does lines, you know, when they, you know, and then they do the straw or the $100 bill, they do all that stuff. You know, you remember all that shit from the 80s and the disco days. So Hunter Thompson walks in and we did not have lines. We had piles, literally piles, like a mountain pile of pure cocaine snow. So he didn't come out for about an hour. So he comes out and to this day, I'm so sorry that BCM, you know, when they changed over there, they deleted a lot of our tapes and stuff like that. And I never kept the tape, but we had a tape of Hunter Thompson going, hey, this is Hunter Thompson. And whenever I'm in Boston, WBCN is my favorite station. In fact, it's my favorite station in the whole world, but I can't tell you why.
I'm sensing a trend here, among other things, that you're a great negotiator with the right tools, first for yourself and then for Hunter.
Yeah, well, I, you know, a lot of people made fun of me because I would they said that my house in Dover was the house that Dunkin' Donuts coffee built, or that so-and-so's legal seafood built. Because what I would do is I would have, or that this Joe's Plumbing, you know, Jack Lee's Plumbing did. It's like anytime that I needed something done at my house, I would just call these people and say, hey, can you do this for me? And I'll give you time on the radio. And it worked out like the old barter system in the colonial days, because they would rather I talk about them on the radio than me pay them money, because when I talked about them on the radio, it was a boon for them. So all these restaurants would come and bring us food. And yeah, I was able to negotiate because I had a 100,000 watt radio station behind me and a lot of credibility at the time.
And dare I say, a fair amount of talent too. You're much too modest, but you know, you don't stay around radio that long without the talent.
What was the question you were going to go to?
I don't know. Maybe we wrapped it up. Now, I was going to mention that on your website, there are some good air checks of Dwayne and Oedipus just shooting the breeze on a Saturday afternoon, I think.
That's when Oedipus, we locked the station. We locked ourselves in. We wouldn't let anybody else in. Not me, Dwayne and Oedipus did. Not me.
Yeah. No, it's always Dwayne, right? Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. Charles Lacquadero, radio legend in Boston, sharing the great stories with us. Thank you so much for taking some time.
You want to hear one more story about Dwayne?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So at the time when Dwayne was at his peak, you would understand this, but a lot of your viewers and listeners might not. The radio stations were rated by a research company. One of them was ARB, Arbitron Research Bureau. And ARB ratings were so important to radio station managers and station owners, because if the ratings were good, then the salespeople could go out and say, hey, look, our station is number two, number one, we're in Charles Lafayette, you know. So the ARB was really a big deal. If you get good ratings, then everybody drank champagne and had a great time and stuff. So Dwayne Glasscock is on the radio and he goes, one Saturday morning, his show was 10 to 2. And I speak about him in the third person, if you don't mind.
That's so, okay.
So Dwayne is on the radio and he goes, you know, he's like 18 years old and he's got a Boston accent. He says, you know, there's this company down in Beltsville, Maryland. They all these guys, they drive around, these big fat guys with cigars, and they drive around in their big black Cadillacs and smoke their cigars. And it's ARB, Arbitron Research Bureau. And these guys are secret guys. These guys, they decide what, how much money this drug is going to get. They decide all this stuff because they do the ratings. And they lie because right now, and by the way, during that time period in Boston, if a research company gave you a 4, it was like a great rating. You could use that number for. And Dwayne Glasscock, and you can Google this or ask Carter Allen this. Dwayne Glasscock consistently every Saturday from 10 to 2 had a 13, not a 4, a 13.
Whoa!
So that being said. So Dwayne goes on the air. He said, so these guys, and they only gave us a 4. And right now I'm at the Prudential now, and I'm looking outside the window. They gave me a 13. There's 14 people right outside the window looking at me, and the phones, there's 3 phone things lit up. So I got at least a 17, so they lie. So you know what to do? And now everybody's sad around here. And nobody's happy because we got the 4 and the 13. So just what I want you to do, send a bag of shit to Arbitron Research Bureau, box 1114, gave the exact address in Belcher Mill, the total address, and did that every break, every 15 minutes between 10 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. Said, don't forget, send a bag of shit. Now, remember, put it in a cellophane bag because you don't want the postman to get it all over. And it can be doggy stuff. It can be your stuff. It can be any stuff. And just send it to the Arbitron Research Bureau box. And he did that and did that and did that over and over the whole show. So that's fine. So Monday morning, Charles Lacordaire, not Dwayne, Charles is on the air. Dwayne, a guy named Clee Dobra, who was the guy that hired me during that incident where they brought me back. Kleedobra was his name, and he had a boat. He wore deck shoes and no socks and all that sort of stuff. And so he said he goes in my studio. He opens the door and right during my show, and he goes, Charles, I want to see you after my show. So I go in to see him after the show, and he said, sit down. And he's got this big cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and he's so pissed off. Because he's a white guy, you know, an old white guy. And the veins are coming out of his forehead and his neck and stuff. And he's stirring the coffee with his finger. He's so pissed off. And he looks at me and he goes, now, Charles Lacordaire is the consummate professional and a true asset to the radio station. But Dwayne Glasscock is a fucking asshole. And he's never going to work on this fucking station again on my station. Do you understand? Dwayne is out. And I go, Clee, you can't do that. Dwayne's got like a 13. I mean, all consistent. He goes, as he's staring, are you talking with a full deck? You're acting like you're not Dwayne. And I said, you just fired him and you kept me. Anyway, Dwayne, it didn't last. It was 2-3 weeks. And then because of the owner actually overruled him and brought Dwayne back. But anyway, that was my Dwayne story, and that's a true story.
That's excellent.
I hired Dwayne.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to share some of your memories. Excellent stuff.